That whole library scene is bananas.
It is. It's an insane sequence.
It's maybe one of the better parts of the movie.
To 11 in terms of weirdness.
Yeah, I mean, I think like for me, starting with the hotel scene.
Yes.
With where Britta's going back to the hotel room, like everyone's door is like popping up, and everyone's like staring down after.
That was effectively that bit and the library bit. Those felt effectively unsettling, like a dream.
Is that hotel just a holding pattern for his? People
that's what I assume. I assume it's basically just like to keep everyone together.
In the theory of
took over a hotel,
is that they're the ones that didn't press the button and are now one of his quote unquote employees.
I guess they could be. I don't think that's necessarily true.
That was a theory I read. Okay. I don't know if it's true.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe. I mean, we should save all this chat for the movie, but I don't know if I believe that.
But then who are they?
I think it just seems like at random points he just like mentally takes over random people who happen to be nearby.
Yeah,
right?
But then he does also have a bunch of people that he is sending to the other place, and Britta is in those people.
Right.
And
then, so like I guess somehow he's like coerced these people into being part of this operation.
When she sits down in her room and then she just looks up at the crazy yarn board, she's looking at it like she's never seen it before. But I'm like, that's obviously impossible.
I mean, is it, Chris? Why would you say anything is obviously impossible
that's true.
Could be the first time she's ever seen this board before.
That's true.
Yeah.
It is entirely possible that that board was not there when she left, she's never actually observed this room before in her life.
That's
you know,
true.
Like.
Where three friends sit down with a troubled movie, a themed cocktail, and talk about what worked, what didn't, and how they would fix it. I am Chris, Water Coffin Triptych Revelle.
I am Lee. Your car is a box with wheels. Galahanty.
And I am Brendan James Marsden's Marsden Tristan.
These nicknames can only add up to us having seen one film, and that is Richard Kelly's The Box.
You know, this computer is kind of a box.
You know,
it's a flat box, but a box nonetheless.
You know, this coffee table is
a bit of a box. The TV that we watched on, also rather a box. Yes, we are boxes.
Would you say our bodies are sort of like boxes?
Boy, you want to talk about boxy bodies. Take a look at my ex-wife. Am I right? Take a look at my wife, Clybina.
Hey,
am I right?
Hey, isn't masculinity the ultimate box?
The box which we must all fight our ways out of, yes.
Can anyone, what year did this come out?
This came out in '09.
In 2009.
This came out in 2009, released by Warner Brothers, had a budget of $30 million and made $33.3 million.
Dear.
So clearly did not make a lot of money back, did not recoup.
Starring.
This is also, I just want to throw out real quick, this is one of, you guys remember CinemaScore?
Yeah.
This is one of like 21 movies to receive an F in CinemaScore.
Really?
Yes. Anytime like a movie receives an F in CinemaScore, you know that it's because it is literally insane or just is that bad. It's,
so typically CinemaScore is the one where they're just getting audience takes on the way out, right?
Right. CinemaScores are almost always the worst thing you get is a C+.
Right.
If you get below that, then it's like, oh boy, we really fucked up here.
And I could definitely see this movie, even if it were to be something that we sat down and were like, oh my god, this is secretly a masterpiece, it's very confusing, so I could definitely see it being like, yeah, that was an F.
Yeah,
I don't know what
like,
I just
to be
saw.
Clear, I'm pretty sure, like, Mother got a CinemaScore F2, and that's not saying it's a bad movie, just that it's an incredibly confusing movie that the average audience has neither the patience for nor interest in.
Right.
I'm not saying that means it's a bad movie, I'm just saying, interesting note, this is one of the few movies that cinema viewers were uniformly like, it bad.
Although it is pretty bad. And it's starring, we have Cameron Diaz, James Marsden, Frank Langella,
James Rebhorn, Holmes Osborne.
Who plays Grandmom? I recognize her.
Yeah, Celia Weston.
Thank you.
She's been in shit before. Gillian Jacobs is Dana/Sarah Matthews. Deborah Rush is Climene Stewart. And I think that's probably...
That's about it.
John Magara is a little shit kid.
What drink did we have to get us through this?
So the drink we made for the box was called Button Button. It is 2.5 ounces of bourbon, 1/2 ounce of honey syrup, blueberries, blackberries, cardamom bitters, Luxardo cherries, and sparkling water. You make, first of all, box ice cubes. I have a large square ice cube tray, and I mixed Luxardo cherry syrup and a little bit of water together with a Luxardo cherry in it, stirred it up, the cherries sank to the bottom, froze those ice cubes, They became large, box-like, dark ice cubes. The idea was supposed to be that the cherry would look a little like the button in the movie, but it is very hard to get cherries to sit still, and I tried once to put the cherry on top in the freezer, and it just looked bad. So, anyway, once you have your box ice cubes, you can place one box ice cube in an old-fashioned glass. In a shaker, combine the bourbon, the honey syrup, the bitters, and a few of both types of berries. Muddle the ingredients, then add ice. Shake until chilled and strain into a glass. You add sparkling water to fill up the rest of the glass. Give it a gentle stir, and there is your button, baby.
It was quite tasty. Even if the box image conceit we were trying to do with the ice cube didn't quite make it, I thought the drink itself was delish. I love black cherries, so I was very down for this flavor.
Yes, Luxardo cherry is the only type of cherry to use in a drink. Don't use those fake
maraschinos.
Yes, those fake maraschino cherries. Use the good stuff, guys.
It was all right.
From Delahanty. That's a riff.
Yeah, it was a little, I don't know, the fruitiness was a little too much for me. I think I'm just like, if I want like a whiskey cocktail, I want like whiskey, like a bit of lemon.
Closer to maybe like an old fashioned.
Yeah, rub a little something in there. Not too much like fruitiness with whiskey.
But like maybe like an orange peel.
Orange citrus. Yeah. Berry and whiskey is not a good combo for me, I don't think. It was all right.
Yeah, that was pretty delish. It got me quite buzzed off of just one, so I mean, that might be.
I mean, sleepy. I don't know if I noticed a buzz, but I felt sleepy in it. I might still have another coffee later.
I still feel a little sleepy right now. So before we jump into pulling this thing apart, Brendan, I believe you were going to look up our good friend Wikipedia.
Yes.
To see what they have to say about the box.
I'll try and summon some gravitas to make this sound logical.
What if Frank Langella was monologuing the plot at us?
The film opens with a CIA internal memo about Arlington Steward, a man who has recovered from severe burn wounds and is delivering units related to the Mars Project. Set in 1976, the story follows Norma and Arthur Lewis, who awaken one morning to find a mysterious package on their doorstep. Inside is a wooden box with a button protected by a glass dome, a key, and a note saying that Mr. Steward would visit at 5 p.m. Norma and Arthur have breakfast with their son, Walter, before Arthur heads into work at NASA, where he works in optics and was involved in designing the camera for the Viking Mars probe. Arthur learns he has been rejected from the astronaut program due to failing the psychological exam. Norma, who teaches literature at an elite private school, reveals her disfigured right foot to her class during a discussion on Sartre's vision of hell. She learns from her boss that her tuition discount for Walter's school is being revoked, causing financial concern. Later, Arlington Steward, a man with a severely disfigured face, arrives at their door as promised. He presents an offer. If they press the button, someone they do not know will die, and they will receive $1 million. Arlington leaves them with 24 hours to decide. After much deliberation, Norma impulsively presses the button. Arlington returns and gives them the money, implying that someone close to them may die as a consequence. Arthur attempts to return the money, but Arlington leaves abruptly. Later, Arthur and Norma attend a wedding rehearsal dinner, where Arthur encounters a student of Norma's and sees a box similar to the one left on their doorstep, containing a photograph of Arlington. Arthur's investigation into Arlington's background reveals his car is registered to the NSA. Concurrently, Norma receives a cryptic warning from a stranger at a supermarket, instructing her to look up a library call number and not trust Arthur. Arlington chastises Norma for involving the police, as Arthur had asked Norma's father, a police officer, to run Arlington's license plate. At home, Arthur's encounter with their babysitter, Dana, reveals she is not who she claims to be. She directs him to look in the mirror for answers, before disappearing mysteriously. Further, Arthur discovers Arlington's photo in a picture from his work at NASA. Arthur and Norma each separately visit a library, each following clues leading to Arlington. Arthur, guided by Arlington's wife, navigates through three water gateways, choosing the correct one based on a prior hint. Norma, guided by Arlington, reflects on her disfigurement and experiences a moment of emotional connection with him. Norma and Arthur reunite at home, where Arthur emerges from the water portal and they find Walter demanding answers. At a wedding, their son is kidnapped and Arthur is abducted by a former NASA employee who reveals he faced a similar choice between his wife and his daughter. Arthur is shown a manual and water portals, but is interrupted by a Santa Claus figure. A Santa Claus-esque figure before being struck by a truck. Arthur emerges from a NASA warehouse surrounded by military personnel. Back home, Arlington offers them the final choice. Live with their $1 million and a deaf-blind son, or Arthur can shoot Norma, restoring Walter's senses and securing the money for his future. They learn Arlington's employees are testing humanity's worthiness. Norma and Arthur decide to sacrifice Norma. After she is shot, Walter's senses are restored, and Arlington delivers the million to another couple who have pressed the button. The film concludes with Arthur being taken away by the authorities, indicating the cycle of testing will continue.
I cannot recommend the experience of, and I don't know if it's going to be as good as this one, but of reading the Wikipedia summary before you watch the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then having to unpack, like, what's happening? What's happening here?
Yes. It is one of those things where if you're reading this, you're like, how the hell does this possibly, like, translate to, a movie? Like,
trying to understand what water portals.
Yes, right.
And
yes.
What do you mean? Why is he a Santa Claus figure?
Right. He is.
Well, and which is a weird way of just saying it's a guy in a Santa Claus
outfit. He's dressed like Santa. Yeah. Just say it's a guy dressed like Santa.
I mean, I would also
bell ringer.
I would also just ask, like, why mention that at all? Given the things you omit for a synopsis, why even mention they had to stop the car because there was a guy dressed as Santa Claus on the road, and then they got hit by another car. Just say, like, they get into a car accident.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, real quickly, I'll go through some of the cast. Cameron Diaz is Norma Lewis. James Marsden is Arthur Lewis. Frank Langella is Arlington Stewart. James Rebhorn is Norm Cahill, who the synopsis doesn't really mention, but that's Jason or James Marsden's boss at NASA. Holmes Osborne is Dick Burns, who is Cameron Diaz's, Dick Burns, who's Cameron Diaz's dad.
Hopefully not a case of nominative determination.
Yeah.
Sam Oz Stone is Walter Lewis. Gillian Jacobs is Dana, who is a babysitter, who I don't think they really mentioned too much in this description, but she's a babysitter.
Or is she?
Celia Weston is Lana Burns, Cameron Diaz's mom, and Deborah Rush is Climbing Stewart. I think that's kind of really about it. John Magaro is there as a baby.
Oh, the other thing that I was like, what's happening here? Was when it says, like, they both go to get separate clues, and then it's like, Norma forms an emotional connection.
Yes.
That's a clue?
Yes. Well, and then it... Because I did a similar thing. It had been a while since I had seen the movie. The Wikipedia summary seems to imply that she has some kind of connection with him. I don't really feel like she does.
I mean, I don't think she does. I don't know that I got that from the Wikipedia synopsis, but maybe I missed something.
Well, just that she connects emotionally with...
Well, it's that one scene where he's like, when you saw me, what did you feel?
You.
And she's like, I felt love. And he's like, not pity. She's like, nope, love.
I'm unclear if he's like a person still.
No, I don't believe he is.
Yeah, my assumption would be no.
I think he's an alien consciousness wearing a human.
Is
a dead
his soul
human.
Gone and he's just now...
Yes.
I get the impression that
there is a person, perhaps, with a soul speaking through him.
I think that there is an alien...
I think there's a creature.
Yeah, there's like some sort of alien consciousness.
Well, are you saying aliens don't have souls?
I don't know.
I don't think they do. I think,
don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think God would have said something in the Bible about aliens having souls.
P.S. Aliens have them too.
Yeah, so I'm going to say no, they don't have souls.
I think that there's some degree of, maybe not empathy, but of like concern. I think that there's a sort of vague depiction that maybe he's invested in humanity, not fucking this up.
Yeah, no, I think because he does say to them at the end something like, I want you to know I hold you both in the highest regards and I'm very sorry you pushed the button.
Yeah.
He does seem like he is doing this test because there is some other force compelling him to do so, but
and
he would really like you to not fail this test.
Right, and that he does want humanity to prove themselves.
Yeah.
So I could see that there would have been maybe an emotional connection there.
I think the emotional connection that she has is forged solely off of immediately seeing him, not knowing that this is some weird guy. Just seeing a guy with a weird disfigurement and being like, I think I have it rough because I have this issue with my foot, but this is a guy who his face is disfigured. You can't really conceal that.
You're right. She might limp or whatever, but his is obviously much more.
Right, it's there. Yeah, it's full out there. Yeah. A little harder to go day to day, hitting up the library with climbing.
So we'll get into all of these details, but I wanted to just start with the source material for this. How many people, except for myself,
I've read
remember
button.
Reading
yeah.
the short story
button
it. Button.
I never had to read it.
I wrote down a quick...
Yeah, if you'd like,
a brief recap of it.
I did reread it recently just to be like, how close is it to this? And I'm like, it's not...
I mean, it is.
It's like the first, like,
right, I was
going to
say, the first act is kind of it. But so Arthur and Norma Lewis are given a box with a button on it and told by a strange man, Mr. Stewart, that if they press the button, they will get $50,000 and someone they don't know will die. Arthur is against it and throws Stewart out along with his box. Norma later calls Stewart using a phone number on a business card left with them, but little additional information is provided. After she ends the call, she finds that the box has been returned to her in secret. She she hides the box without telling Arthur. While Norma hypothetically discusses the box's moral quandary with Arthur the next morning, he remains opposed to pushing the button while she attempts to justify it. The next day when Arthur is at work, she pushes the button partly because of how ridiculous she finds the whole situation. Nothing seems to happen. Later in the day, Norma gets a call from a hospital telling her that Arthur has died in a subway accident. When she realizes that she will receive $50,000 from Arthur's life insurance policy, she angrily smashes the box apart, revealing that there is nothing electronic inside of it. Norma is called again by Stewart, who tells her that she never really knew her husband.
Right.
And so that's basically it. It's all kind of a riff on, like, the monkey's paw thing, mm-hmm. this version, where it's, you know, you make a wish, but the wish has ironic unintended consequences, which I'm pretty sure is something that literally happens in the monkey's paw, where someone wishes for money and they find out that they get it because of an insurance policy on a loved one who has died.
Well, and the reveal of, like, oh, but did you actually know this loved one feels very... very Twilight Zone-y, which is also appropriate for mm-hmm. Richard Matheson. He wrote a lot of stuff that became Twilight Zone stuff, or he just straight up wrote a lot of things for a kind of anthology horror speculative yeah. television. A lot of his short stories are like that as well. Obviously, you know, the meaning of this adaptation's a little bit different. There was also one in the 80s.
Right, yeah. So it was adapted when Twilight Zone was having a revival series in mm-hmm. the 80s, which is generally thought to be, like, not as good as the original.
The bad.
yeah, the bad Twilight Zone. There was an adaptation of Button Button that Richard Matheson did not like, and he mm-hmm. had his name taken off the script because it changed the ending. Its story is largely similar, except that they imply that the couple is kind of, like, worse off. Like, they're kind of living in a shitty right. apartment. And also, it's a little bit more, like, leaning into the standard trope of Norma being sort of, like, a shrewish, domineering right. wife, and Arthur being kind of like a henpecked milquetoast husband with that milquetoast bullshit.
And I think it also being in the 80s has this extra thing of, like, you're choosing your own, like, you're choosing getting wealth knowing that it's going to literally end someone else's life.
There's a little, yeah. I mean, the other, obviously, the major change is that the ending is different in the Twilight Zone episode, whereas in the short story, her husband is killed in an accident and she gets money from his insurance policy. In this one, it is almost sort of identical to what happens in the first part of this movie, where it's just Arlington Stewart shows up, takes the box back and says, great, here's your money. Now the box will be reprogrammed and given to someone you don't know, implying, yeah, that she will die next if the next person who takes the box decides to also push the button. There were two basic things that I just sort of thought were interesting just yeah. in discussing the short story. One is that they were based off of two different concepts. Matheson's wife apparently was taking some sort of psych class at mm-hmm. college at that point, and the professor posed a question which was something akin to, if you could contribute immensely to world peace by walking naked down Broadway, would you do so?
Huh.
And it's interesting how that almost doesn't have a whole lot to do with this story as it is. That story is more like, would you humiliate yourself to do something good?
Greater good.
And this is more like, will you take something immediately that benefits you in order to do that? Will ultimately do something bad for someone else. And it's
you
just...
You can see how it's in the same ballpark,
right.
but it's not exactly the same idea.
Right. There is also something apparently called Chateaubriand's paradox, which mm-hmm. was, like, from a French writer who said, and this is, you know, a direct quote, if thou couldst by a mere wish kill a fellow creature in China and inherit his fortune in Europe with the supernatural conviction that the fact would never be known, wouldst thou consent to form such a wish? So that feels more directly tied into, like, what
yes.
this is. If you could kill someone and take all their money and no one would ever be able to prove it was you, would you do that? So that's really kind of the quandary of the short story, The Box.
Well, and even if no one else knows, you know what happens.
Right, yeah.
I would say the first one has a slightly different meaning, but it's still about that moral choice of, like,
right.
oh, yeah,
oh, yeah,
you
yeah,
want
no.
that money, you get the
yeah.
money. It's just a matter of, the twist is different, right? But it's like, it's,
right,
it's
right.
kind of still decide, they both have... Actually, they all have the same core conceit of, like...
Would you do this
yeah, you need
to
money.
Get money?
Would you kill someone for
right,
it
yeah.
if you didn't have to do the dirty work?
Right. I mean, yeah, it is still ultimately the same sort of moral quandary. There are little details that change in one version to
yeah.
the other, but at the end of the day, you're sort of asking the same question. It's
yeah.
just the ending that alters what it might mean.
I think it says more about the economy than it does about morality.
So, I mean, considering the economy we're in, would you press the button that we're
well,
left
I'm
on your
saying,
doorstep?
To have it be money, right?
Uh-huh.
It's a very capitalist
question,
yes.
question
right. yeah.
because for it to be a moral choice, it's not a trolley problem, right? It's
mm-hmm.
not like
no.
who's going to die. Because my issue with this whole conceit is, like, especially in this movie, where it's sort of amped up, where they try to make the people as desperate as possible before they give them this
mm-hmm,
choice so
mm-hmm.
that it the
they're kind of forced
to
make the
yeah,
yeah.
they're forced to press the button. Like you were saying, they're almost pushing them to press the button. They
right.
want them to press the button.
Right.
But that's not like a solid moral choice.
Right, because you're already pushing your finger on the scale.
You're pushing your finger on the scale, but if you're deciding they talk about how this is to decide if somebody can sort of think about the greater good versus mm-hmm. some selfish gain. Mm-hmm. This comes down to like a binary choice where mm-hmm. it's like, I have people in my life that are in need. And am I going to help? Am I going to protect them, or am I going to protect some random stranger that right. I don't know? Right. And that is like not really. That's like a one for one choice. Mm-hmm. And if you ask like any sane, normal person, they're probably going to pick the person that they love over a random stranger.
Of course,
like, it's unlikely that they're going to pick the random stranger. And that's not really like a good judge of morality. Someone's going to potentially die no matter what, which is why the money thing makes it very interesting, because people tie that money in these worlds to their happiness and their security. Yes. And their security.
Yeah.
But like really the proper test of this would be like, I'm holding a gun to your son's head.
Right.
Right.
If you tell me to, I'll shoot him.
Yeah.
But if you don't, someone else is going to die.
Gonna die. Like that's really like kind of the choice that people think that they're making underneath all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this layer to make it seem like it's about greed, but I don't think that it's on these people.
No.
I think the world makes us think that we need this money because we kind of do need this money.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why I take issue with the implication. I mean, I do. It's implied in this movie that they are trying to foment a situation where someone would want to press the button.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like then you're not getting a clean read of the data here.
Right. Well, that's what I meant in terms of like you're putting your finger on the scale. Right. You're already like backing these people into a corner more than you normally would.
And I understand maybe the point of like, well, truly moral people would be able to overcome that. But I'm like, then are you really testing morals, or are you just testing like the system these people are already in?
Yeah, I mean, that's like a whole complicated philosophical issue that we could easily spend like the entire time speaking about. And I think like that's a very valid thing to sort of, you know, want to bring up, frankly, because it is one has to assume in the movie itself that the quasi difficult situation that this couple finds themselves in is influenced in some way by Arlington Stewart and whoever is controlling him. Because you have the scene where the principal or the headmaster of the school is talking to Cameron Diaz and he says, like, I'm sorry, the faculty, like, child tuition discount is no longer in effect. You're going to have to pay full tuition cost if you want your son to go here. James Marsden finds out at work, which I assume is also, you know, given that the Arlington Stewart beings are involved in NASA and the NSA, that he was angling on getting some sort of promotion to astronaut and is not getting promoted to astronaut like he initially wanted. And so it does feel sort of like these things are not just like sheer dumb luck.
Right.
These are things that were engineered by whoever it is that is testing them. It would be one thing to just sort of show up one day and be like, you're a typical happy middle class couple. You've got a kid. Everything's like working relatively okay for you. Like mm-hmm. you could be better off, but you could be worse off. What would you do if I gave you this box?
Then it makes a little more sense that this is a greed test, right? Because if all other things are equal and things are otherwise fine, and then you're making the choice to let someone else's life end so you can get more money.
Right.
Yeah. Then I get how this is a, like, well, that's fucked up of you.
I think in the very least, it's not a fair test to only test one end of the spectrum. To only test, like, the desperate people who mm-hmm. are trying to keep their loved ones protected and safe.
Right.
So what are you punishing there? How dare you want to provide for the people you love?
Yeah. So I really have two problems with this test. I have a problem that it's money-based and uh-huh. not more directly tied to
a person's life,
a person's life over a stranger's life or whatever. And I have a problem with the fact that they are engineering these to be as desperate as possible. There are selfish people.
Right.
I would in a heartbeat kill someone just to have
a little more.
Right, right. If you gave this to Elon Musk and gave this to a single parent with three kids, one of those people, I feel like pushing that button is more allowable than
justify,
the other one,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
like you could justify if you literally are just, I don't know how we're going to live day to day at this point, versus someone who's like, well, I have a lot of money, but I could always have a little bit more.
Now, I would say it is also complicated in this movie, just to get into how we see it happen. Yes, it does suck that she can't send her kid to that private school, but then go to public school. Yes, it does suck you're not an astronaut, but you're still employed at NASA? Like, I'm sure you're still gainfully employed there?
Right. I mean, like, this is the thing. Like, Norma, at one point, Cameron Diaz says that they're living paycheck to paycheck. I don't want to say that I find that impossible. I certainly can, but I would argue that it's not so much that they're living in paycheck to paycheck, it's that you're living beyond your means.
Which she also notes at one point. She says, you know that you...
We're spending way too much money.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, then downsize.
I mean, this is one of those things where it's like, if that is your point, if you want the point to be, we were sort of upwardly mobile and we thought that maybe we would be able to swing all of this shit with the situation we were going to be in. Like, you know, we've punted the consequences down the road a few years. Be like, well, 5 years from now, like, we'll be able to afford all this mm-hmm. and we won't have to worry about it. And then you're realize that that's not the case. That's a whole other situation than we're living paycheck to paycheck because we're simply not making enough money to live versus we're not making enough money to accommodate the lifestyle that we've created for ourselves. And that's kind of interesting that the movie to me doesn't really talk about that too much. That's one of the big, I think, character defining things that this movie sort of ducks. The movie does some decent work explaining, I think, the justification and the logic of Norma and Arthur deciding to do what they do. But that is the one thing that it feels like is never sufficiently addressed. Like, yeah, you could send your kid to private school. Public school. Why don't you send your kid to public school? And I get it. Sometimes public schools are in bad areas. They're not great. And like, you want your kid to have all the advantages that a kid can have. This is not the end of the world.
They're not really backed into much of a corner.
Right.
And the movie seems to believe that they are. I feel like we are led to feel that they are in incredibly dire straits.
Yeah, certainly based on the other adaptations that we have discussed, they seem the least desperate.
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree. Yes.
However, they are still deliberately being put here by the people.
Right.
And there's an external force that's turning up the heat.
Yeah. It's not like they're having a stroke of bad luck or that they're not capable of doing this. He would have passed the astronaut test.
She
would have kept getting that tuition.
Now, if they really wanted to fuck with him and put them in a desperate space, they would have stolen and burned all of Cameron Diaz's scarves.
No! My scarf budget!
Because then her head would just fall off.
Yeah, that's how she keeps her head on.
I just kind of wanted to talk about, like, what is this about? What are the actual themes here? Because this movie throws a lot at us.
All right, so I have a list I made here of what I think themes are of this movie. There's about 25 things that I wrote down. Some of them overlap. But here's what we've got. Just think about this.
Okay.
Disability.
Yep.
Greed.
Yep.
Guilt. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Mercy or grace. Mm-hmm. Hell is other people.
Yep.
People seeing you for who you truly are. Free will. Does it exist? Are our actions preordained? Altruism, existentialism, taking less for yourself for the benefit of a larger community. What are the actual scopes of your actions? Would you commit unethical actions if you don't directly live with the consequences? How can a person ignore their negative effects on the larger world? Water? Mirror images? Duplicity? Duplicates? Boxes? The afterlife? A higher power? The parental relationship to children? The parental relationship compared to whatever organization it is in this movie controlling all these things? And of course, the old sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic thing that you get.
I would say maybe some of these themes are more discussed in dialogue than they are shown in, like...
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that all themes that are given equal credence in this movie. I'm saying that they are all themes that you could look at and pick up on and try to work backward from.
I think there's a little bit of facetiousness in there of putting, like, boxes and water in there.
I mean, I am, but here's the thing. So, like, I agree. There is a little bit, but this is the thing. They fucking talk about box. There is literally a monologue where Frank Langella is like, let me tell you about boxes.
Your nickname.
That is the weakest bit of dialogue.
Oh, no, I'm not saying all these are well done. If you look at the wallpaper patterns, a lot of them are boxes.
Right.
When there's a literal box aesthetic motif being thrown on this movie. So I do think that's a thing.
It's called a box. I just think it's meant to be in it. Not trying to say something deep about boxes, whatever Frank Langella thinks he's saying.
No, but I mean, there's also the whole, if you have the whole no exit thing, it's like these people are trapped inside a box effectively.
Yeah.
So it's like, what?
You know, your car is a box with wheels.
Yeah. I don't get it.
You know, you go home and you stare into a box.
And I mean,
your home is also a box.
I think the water thing is more just... I feel like this is weirdly tying into Donnie Darko, where Richard Kelly uses water a lot in that movie. He also talks about free will a lot in that movie. There's a lot to do with reflections in this. Images of people in mirrors. Gilly is like, look into the mirror or something when she's talking to James Marsden.
Right.
Water, reflection, and mirrors are something in here. Would this also...
What was she getting at?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Look in the mirror.
I assume it's just sort of, like, I guess if I were to say anything, it would just be that, like, you are the only person who can resolve this now. Yeah. Like, stop asking your father-in-law. Don't depend on the police. Like, this is up to you.
It is funny later when he goes to the bar cart and like sees himself in the mirror there and he has this pause like, huh? And it's just like, well, what are you really seeing?
Damn, I am good looking. And I mean, like I said, like, the water thing feels like something that's tied into Donnie. Like, a lot of this shit here feels like ideas he kicked around with Donnie Darko and then was like, but what if I also talked about them in the box?
The water thing looked kind of visually and felt similar to the time travel bits from Donnie
Darko. Yeah, it does. And Donnie Darko has this whole thing about, like, water and metal being used as vessels to travel through time. So it does feel sort of this whole idea of water portals. Like, if you go into the swimming pool, you can pop out in that wind tunnel at Langley where Frank Langella's hanging out.
Where he also has a, like, vertical moat of water kind of going. I think that's
like a portal. Like that's just the portal where you'll pop in and out of. So sorry. So and I also told you guys that I had read an earlier draft of this screenplay, which you can find pretty easily online from 2006. A lot of the broad strokes are largely the same. The details are so wildly different. I had told you before that Dana Gilly's character is a child
who like goes to this.
Right. A lot of her dialogue, I think, makes more sense when it's spoken by a child. Norma's brother, who dropped the barbell on her foot, is a character who is at the wedding, which is one of those things that's like, it is kind of weird that she mentions, oh, her brother dropped a dumbbell on her foot. But like, you never see this guy. The doctor who performed the operation on her foot is invited to the wedding because this sort of thing where like someone knows him through someone else. There's this like simmering resentment that they have toward like the doctor who botched her foot operation. And like he shows up at one point and he's a vessel being controlled by Arlington Stewart too at the wedding. And I think literally the most insane thing that comes up is that halfway through the movie, Arlington Stewart has a twin brother who is not dead, who shows up. And you see Arlington Stewart like controlling him because you see like a scene of him talking, of the brother talking to police. And Arlington Stewart is mimicking the body motions that he would be doing. And he's just doing the exact same thing. And then at the end, Arlington Stewart has to like talk entirely through his twin brother because like his body is decomposing too much or something like that. And like this is why I'm saying I think the water has something to do with reflections in twins, but I don't know what. I'm thinking that this is a visual motif that you, Richard Kelly, find interesting. I don't know why it's here and I don't know what you're doing with it, but it seems that you find water and reflection an interesting concept.
The way that there's just the sheer amount of themes, whether or not they're explored sufficiently or not, I think really contributes to this very uncanny, I'm trapped in a nightmare kind of feeling.
Oh, 100%.
Which at times I actually found to be pretty effective, much like a nightmare or a dream, doesn't really add up to a coherent story that you can track. And like, if even though the themes are present, you're not sure how they really connect.
Lee, you had said when we were watching this, like, the story makes sense.
The story is pretty simple.
Right. The core story here, you could follow very easily.
Obfuscated by just a bunch of weird nonsense.
Right. It's like, then when you start piling all these other things, like, you know, No Exit and Sartre.
And people just staring randomly.
Yeah, and the theme of people staring randomly on top of this movie, it almost, like, diverts your attention
if
in a way.
If I can bring up another interlude that makes no sense and I still don't understand what the fuck that was about.
Yep.
What is the... I don't understand what was supposed to happen, what was supposed to be the point of him choosing one of three random...
Yeah, okay. That thing, that is like the one... I think that is like the one sequence in the movie that I legitimately cannot make sense of. You know, it's like, I think there are other things where I can sort of be like, I'm see kind of what you're doing here.
Yeah.
But that is the one where I'm just like, is something... Is there a deleted scene somewhere explaining this?
So like, to spell this out,
yeah,
the real nuts and bolts boils down to plot is once they press the button... It all comes down to they're going to have to make some kind of sacrifice to undo the fact they have fucked up. Pressing the button was a mistake. To undo the press of the button, it comes down to this final sacrifice of like, hey, your kid's deaf and blind. You can kill your wife who pressed the dump button. And that's going to bring your son back.
And from of all the situations we see, it's always the wife who has pressed the button.
Yeah, yeah. Those wives. Or you can live with your deafblind son with the money and be happy.
Yeah.
And he pretty clearly is like, killing you is the right option.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We don't want to pick the one where your son is deaf and blind. That's bad. In case you're too dumb to figure that out, right. I'm going to tell you. So that's really the end, like, point. That's like that's the evolution of the story. And them getting to that point is this nonsense of them chasing down all these weird clues about Arlington and whatever. And then as part of that... I don't understand why he's chasing down, trying to find out who is this Arlington guy, ends up in the room with Arlington's dead wife, who got shot in a library.
Did she get shot?
No, I didn't think
wasn't
she got
that
shot.
Was the one that got shot?
No.
Oh.
The woman who gets shot in the beginning is the guy at the end. Is the guy who takes James Morrison hostage
wife.
You don't really see her,
okay.
So it's irrelevant.
I thought
Arlington was dead. No. I guess she's alive. I mean, who's to say? Alive. Maybe she is dead too. Who's to say?
Yeah. Arlington's story is also somewhat, I mean, it's weird, but it's also somewhat simple when you lay it out. He was a NASA employee. He got struck by lightning.
An NSA employee.
Yeah.
Was he NASA?
No, he was NASA.
Okay.
I don't remember. But he was some government agency employee.
And he got struck by lightning around the same time as the Viking probe was starting to transmit images back from Mars.
Yes.
It's heavily implied that the lightning strike killed him, yes, but then planted in his body an alien consciousness, which is now enacting this whole box plan.
Yeah.
And they are attempting to put out morality tests to human beings, and if they...
To prove that they're worthy.
Right.
Not
right.
being exterminated.
And right. if we hit... If enough of us don't press the button...
The test
our,
will stop.
Then our altruism yeah. coefficient goes yes. up.
Right.
And we get to live. But if enough of us do press the button, it goes down too low, and then they'll just wipe us out.
Right. I think that is, like, as close to definitively true as anything you can kind of say in this
he
movie
to explain
it. He said
something else about even if people don't press the button, that the test will continue. That there'll be other tests.
I don't remember that to be...
I don't either.
Yeah, I could have just not...
There will be other tests.
Because I... Well, I mean, yeah, because I know that the other test thing... I guess maybe the other tests have something to do with, like, the water coffin thing and, like, the blindness, deafness thing.
Then, like, do you just hang out at the BPL reading books
yes.
in that room with Clannady?
Yeah. yeah.
But in any case, to go back to that water coffin thing...
Yeah.
How is that a test? It's like,
no,
I
agree
with you.
Random
doors. Two of them are bad, and one
right.
of them is not bad.
I mean, right, that's the thing, too, because it takes what is framed as a moral quandary and then turns it into a multiple choice.
A game
like,
chance.
It's like, you've done the moral quest, and now it's like, I don't know, pick a number?
Yeah.
And, like, that's, like, I know there's the weird thing with, like, the kid at the rehearsal dinner flashes a number two, and so James Marsden picks box number two, and
yeah.
then, like, later he sees someone else flash number two, so he picks number two. But then that's even, like, what are you testing? Are you testing if people will pick up on...
I don't know.
...the clues that you're giving them? Is this, like, an escape room now at this point, where
and
you're just trying to feed them some information and see how they interpreted it?
And we know that he was controlled at various points, because he has the nose...
Right, yeah,
the,
yeah.
At the...
At the rehearsal dinner.
Rehearsal dinner,
yeah.
thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
So then, was he then also controlled to humiliate Cameron Diaz with the foot thing at the very beginning?
I assume
so that
it's possible.
She would feel more sensitive about the idea they can't afford this surgery?
I mean, that would be my assumption. It almost,
okay.
yeah, it, again, like, I think that's as much of a good guess as you can make for
okay.
some of these things. I mean, for the record, I had this brief quote from Richard Kelly from an interview that I wish I had written down who did it and where it was from, but I was doing this on my phone. Richard Kelly says, "In my mind, I think it's a higher intelligence ultimately conducting a test before Earth is disposed of. At the same time, it's about trying not to present the material by telegraphing everything. Otherwise, you sacrifice the suspense. A movie being a couple steps ahead of you keeps you searching around every corner." So, like, that on one hand tells us what the thought is for the plot of this
uh-huh.
movie, right? On the other hand, that tells us the style of the movie, the directorial choices. So if you look at this movie and think, I don't understand why this is happening, why these people are here, what's the deal with all this water, this is clearly intentional.
Yeah,
you
well, you're definitely ahead of us, Richard Kelly. I'm not even on the same block as you.
Yeah, for real.
We're in different cities.
You're in a different borough of the city.
Yeah.
Like, I am. Yeah, well, and I think especially because you were saying, I think I read the same interview where he mentioned that he was going for trying to create like a 70s style conspiracy
yeah.
or a paranoia thriller. And I think that's definitely present here. I think it actually the movie does a great job of cultivating that feeling of paranoia and not being sure what's going on. I think its issue is it just does that right up until the end and then it's over. And then you're like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, I this is not really a conversation I'm prepared to have at this point because I would need to, like, cite resources and come in with examples and shit. But it's always just an interesting line you can toe between making a movie that's incomprehensible and doesn't matter that it's incomprehensible
mm-hmm.
versus making one that's incomprehensible yet leaves you, the viewer, thinking, I don't understand what the hell is going on. You know, there's a way to do this skillfully and a way to do it that you just feel like you lost 30 minutes of footage at some point. So that's, like, an interesting ability to be able to have. Like, I'm impressed when a director can skillfully present a movie that should not make any sense, but still have it feel like you walk away emotionally satisfied
mm-hmm.
by it.
Do you feel like that was done here?
No, I guess like the question is like, how do you do that for this?
I think that the conspiracy theory plot choice is at odds with the type of narrative you're trying to tell, this morality test.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's really weird that they're like, running around a library hunting for clues in this weird surreal nightmare dream sequence that amounts to essentially absolutely nothing at all.
Yeah.
Because they don't, their job is to not know any of this information.
Right.
Their job is to simply make a moral choice without knowing any information except what Franklin Gillett tells them.
Right.
And so it really doesn't matter what they find out. And in fact, that's kind of like antithetical to what they're supposed to be doing in the narrative as characters. As much as they are interested in learning, I think that they, if you wanted this, they should be not learning anything. They should never have that scene where he
right.
shows up at the fucking NASA headquarters and the guy's like, you gotta do what they say.
Right, right.
James Marsden. It's just nonsense, you know?
That I think like that scene similar to the library, feels the most like something was cut out of here. Because it's so weird that you have a car crash where they're like, the other guy died, but it doesn't seem like there was anyone else with him in the car. Yeah. And the next scene is like James Marsden being dragged out on his knees of like a hangar somewhere. And it's like, who put you here?
Was he water transport?
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, maybe it was, but that is, I don't understand why you ended up here. Why didn't they just take you away immediately at the scene of the crime and be like, we're taking you back to your house now. We've got your wife in the back of the car too. Let's get you back. I don't understand what you gain from the scene of him meeting James Rebhorn and James Rebhorn being like, this is a really big deal now. You gotta like think smart before you do shit.
And is that because now James Rebhorn understands that it's...
Well, all of his scenes are with...
If we step wrong, then the planet may...
They're with like Frank Miller's toady the whole time.
Right.
And he's explaining to this guy, like James Marsden's boss, like, yeah, we're doing a big morality test on humanity before we decide if we're going to kill them all or not.
Yeah, pretty much.
Getting the whole dish, which is like, I understand, I think that he does, I want to be clear that the individual, like, choices stylistically and, like, what the scenes that we get are very cool in isolation of what they're trying to be overall. Mm-hmm. They're very well done. You know, dude knows what he's doing, Richard Kelly. But I don't like the picture that it comes together as a whole. I just don't think it makes sense for it to sort of be this type of movie.
No.
It feels like Donnie Darko and Southland Tales, but in another way, it feels like so much more complicated than either of those two movies, where I feel even something like Southland Tales, where we literally had to make a flow chart to describe like what we thought was happening and who these characters were to each other and what metaphorical purpose they served. That feels like there is something there, and that there are only a couple of topics that we're kicking around for the focus of this movie. Similar to Donnie Darko, like you can find it incomprehensible, but I feel like you could break it down to maybe three or four total themes that this movie is about.
And
this,
and they're like earned.
Yeah.
You see how they're developed.
This one is like almost fascinating by how many ideas it's throwing into the air at any given moment. Like it's truly just shooting concepts at the screen.
It's truly like someone stuffed the blender and turned it on with the lid off, and it is just splattering just mixtures of stuff all around the room. And individual bits and combinations and scenes and sequences are quite effective, like you said, sort of like in isolation, cut off from the rest of the movie. But taken all together, I'm just sort of like, it doesn't feel like there's any there. There's a lot of cool stylistic choices.
I mean, that's never... See, the thing...
The vibe and the mood is really cool.
Counterpoint, what I would say is it feels like there's always too much there. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like there are too many ideas being stuffed into this thing. It's less that there's not concepts and more that there are simply too many concepts.
It just doesn't make a cohesive...
Right, I think that's the thing. Yeah, there is,
that's
like...
That's what I'm...
Right, that is, I think, a big issue with this movie is that at the end of the day, like, I'm not really sure what it's saying 100%. I guess maybe it seems like it kind of has a vaguely nihilistic view of humanity, but it also kind of thinks that maybe like you should be forgiven for your sins or something like that. Like that's just a shot in the dark there. But like, yeah, that is like, whereas with the other two movies that I talked about, the other Richard Kelly movies, like it's very easy to pick up on those couple of concepts and see how they inform the story. And it doesn't always make sense with here. It's like, I don't know which of these 30 concepts to plug into this movie to explain what's happening.
I mean, I don't even know that because the thing is, that's crazy about this movie is that like, I don't think it did sort of assume a nihilistic humanity, but I don't know if I'm right. I don't know if you're right.
I don't either. Yeah, I could be wrong.
Like, I don't know what kind of test result it is when you press the button and then do the good thing at the secondary fail-safe good thing,
right?
Shooting your wife.
And that's...
What is that, a pass? Is that like a B-?
Right, yeah, that's right. That's right. Like, I guess, I kind of... So here's, like, the thing. If you are, obviously, if you have the insane idea to turn Button into his feature-length movie, you clearly realize that you need to have more to it than just that. Like, I guess you could turn it into a 90-minute talkie drama where two characters sort of walk through every single justification and possible answer, and then it's they decide to do it or they don't, and Franklin Jella shows up and is like, I'm giving it to someone else. And that's your movie right there. I think it's not an unwise decision to sort of do a take on this story where Act 1 is just the short story, and then Acts 2 and 3 are sort of the fallout from that choice that you've made. And whether you want to make it supernatural or not at all, you know, whether it's literally just that, like, you have all this money and now you're, like, crushed with guilt or something like that, and it's like, how do you, like, live with yourself at that point? Or there is some sort of, like, shady government conspiracy that is conducting this experiment for God knows what reason. I think that is a solid enough choice in adapting this movie. Where everything kind of gets a little iffy after that is when you, again, start glomming on 30 other concepts to it at this point. It's not a morality tale anymore. It's a paranoid thriller.
I think it's also a matter of, like, in Donnie Darko and in Southland Tales, especially Southland Tales, as wild and as all-encompassing as it got, I could still detect and hold on to a point of view, or at least what I identified was likely what I thought Richard Kelly was trying to say. And I'm sure Richard Kelly had a point with dragging everything he did into the box, but I don't know what that point was. And I think that's what's missing here. I don't know how all of this collected or came together for him in the same way that I feel like I probably do with Donnie Darko and Southland Tales.
Yeah, I mean, I would also just say that, like, for all the absurdities of those two stories, they are likewise fairly straightforward, simple stories, but the trappings, like the bizarre gonzo trappings that he throws onto them, inform the stories a little bit better, or at least it's not so distracting that you're sitting there thinking, wait, what? Like, what are these people doing here? Why are, like, even when you have things like Justin Timberlake doing a music video in Southland Tales, it feels a little bit more organic and, I don't know, like jejune or something like that. But yeah, here there's so much to hang your hat on at any given point.
If you just had to pick one element of this movie to be, like, better fully explained, which would you identify?
I mean,
The water.
I think the water.
What's going on with the water?
Yeah, I agree. Because, like, it almost feels like in this movie, there is a three-tier test going on, where test one is the button that you push. Test two is something to do with the library. And test three is your kid is now deaf and blind. Right. And you
don't understand.
But is there a different three-tier test for someone who didn't press the
button? Exactly, because you're not going to get to the water portal choice.
Right, so I guess, well, that's if you don't press the button, does Arlington Stewart just show up and be like, I see you didn't press the button, thanks a lot, and walk away? And then, like, you wash
them. I'll see you down at the lake.
And then there's the bit where people are being marched into some other
portal. Okay, so that was the one I would have liked some explanation on. Of,
like, who are these people?
Who are those people?
Because I'm
intrigued by this possibility.
When I say water portal, I mean every time there's some, like, I mean all of it. I don't mean that that choose one of these three doors. I mean, what the fuck is all these water portals? I guess the aliens are making them. I'm assuming it's aliens.
Who are the people being marched? Who are the people at the motel?
Yeah.
Who
are the people? Yeah.
Are the nosebleeds just randos? Are those actual chosen people?
I mean, my assumption, this would be
they're being brain controlled.
Right, yeah. My take on this is, one, I think we know pretty clearly that if someone has a nosebleed, it's because they're being brain controlled by either Stewart or one of his, you know, whatever, one of whatever he is, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And the people, my guess would be the people in the motel are also sort of like government employees, but I'm basing this off nothing. You know, this would literally be my thought if
hive-mindy.
No, they do. That's true. And that's one of those things where I was like, are they hive-mindy in the sense that, like, aliens are constantly controlling them? Are they all people who have died and are now being controlled by aliens too? Like, I really don't know.
And it gets even more confusing because the way Gillian Jacobs acts through most of the movie is like a hive mind, where she's kind of blank. There's a little bit of a weird intensity to her energy. She doesn't have, like, natural reactions like you would expect a human to.
Right, but
then,
well,
later, after she passes out in the car and then she comes to, she's suddenly panicked and like, you need to get out of here.
Well, the other thing I would say that when she suddenly panicked is when she's in the kitchen with Walter and you see part of a window behind Walter and you see all of a sudden like a guy has walked by the window and is like staring at her, and she reacts to that, and you never like see the actual person, you just see her sort of be like, oh, what else does your dad like to do? So my read on her was always that she is just someone who is under some sort of pressure, being coerced by this organization, you know, to sort of do what we say for whatever reason. Why is she under their thrall? I couldn't tell you. That is my take on her, is that she's really not really controlled until she starts bleeding.
Well, my understanding is that the nosebleed people aren't like 100% full-time thralls, and I think some of these nosebleed people don't know that they're thralls.
Yes, I agree.
Some of them do seem to be 100% thralls, though, because the guy who is creepily in the I'm in your backyard scene,
he might be, but
that's the same guy who's at the BPL with the books, and he's also in the hotel.
He might be just fuguing out and then waking up somewhere else at the time.
Yeah, right. I agree, because there was the scene with the one waiter where Cameron Diaz is like, why are we here? And he's like, oh, I don't know. She's like, you said I had a phone. Was like, oh, yeah, right there. It is sort of interesting, because it almost implies that you're kind of aware of your surroundings while you're in this sort of state.
Right.
Like, maybe because, like, you're not, like, horribly thrown and being like, wait a minute, I was outside and now I'm in here. Like, it almost feels like, I don't know, is it like waking up from a nightmare or something and being like, oh,
like,
okay, yeah, you did have a phone call. That
so,
would be where the phone is.
That's definitely the weakest, most fucked up. Like, what's going on? What's going on with the people and the nosebleeds in the water?
Yeah,
then,
the water is my I think my biggest.
And then, like, the people in the library seem to be of a different echelon of thrall.
I don't know.
Yeah, that
I think they're all nosebleed. They're all nosebleed people to me.
Yeah, I don't know that I can I see how you would come away with that.
You know what I mean?
No, I get what you're saying, but I don't think that I thought that zombie-ish. Is what I'm saying.
If I've got a shotgun and I'm going like sort of Ash,
Evil Dead.
I'm killing anyone that nosebleeds.
You know what I mean?
Like it's indiscriminate. If you got a nosebleed, you're one of
you're
them.
You're out.
Yeah. No. I agree.
Like that's, I think they're all equal.
Yeah, I mean,
so fucking confusing.
The thing I had written down, just because I was trying to think of the major issue I was having with this, and like you said, the water thing. The number two thing, like I said, really confuses me to begin with. The first time I was watching this, I was wondering if they were like misunderstanding. It was someone flashing a peace sign, right, and they were reading that as the number two, or vice versa.
I thought they were saying two the whole time.
I think he is two. But then there's one point where James Marsden says something like the kid who flashed the peace sign or something.
Isn't he about to pick a number?
Right. That's the thing that throws me.
James Marsden, your character's an idiot.
Right. Because
you wonder you failed the astronaut
right,
test.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, that's even weirder though, because like you saw it and you registered it as the number two, but then later you said he was flashing the peace sign. Like you think you would say he was the kid who was holding up two fingers to me for some reason. Like what a weirdo. But he does seem to acknowledge that it wasn't the number two, or that he thinks it wasn't the number two, but despite thinking that, he still took number two.
Unless he did acknowledge it as a number two in the moment, but then thought that would be weird to say to someone else and was like, yeah, it was a peace sign. I don't know why.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just like, is the idea supposed to be that like, holding up two fingers is the peace sign, and you're supposed to take water coffin triptych number two because that is the good ending, the peaceful ending.
The second present.
Right, that's not the damnation water coffin. That's the good ones. Again, I truly don't know. These are just one of those weird things where it feels like Richard Kelly is sort of fascinated how like the peace sign also is to the number two,
right,
and is like trying to sort of incorporate that throughout the movie.
Just the final thing about the insanity of the water coffin
triptych. Yeah. Oh, because I have another thing on to go.
Because the correct option is just that it takes you home.
Right, but it takes you through a preview of heaven, though, is what they imply.
I guess.
I mean, we say is what they imply.
It's a tunnel of light.
It's a tunnel of light, and he says at one point, I'm pretty sure I remember him saying at one point to Arlington, like, you showed me the afterlife, didn't you?
Okay.
And he also mentions to, when he comes to with Cameron Diaz, he says, I saw like a beautiful place where...
Despair is not the governor of the human heart. Yeah, whatever.
And that taken with the you showed me the afterlife, didn't you, leads me to believe that had he chose the wrong water coffin, which is just such a funny phrase to say, he would have potentially either been sent to hell or would have still gone home but would have seen
hell.
A preview of hell.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
Where so despair is the only governor.
But, and I mean, and this is the whole other thing too, because now we have the concepts of heaven and hell, mm-hmm, and there are higher beings, which are aliens in this movie too, which is one of those things.
Yeah,
and again,
we don't know what the higher beings are. I assume aliens, but it could be, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I assume aliens too, because they talk about how like it happened at the same time that the Mars probe was taking pictures and lightning struck Arlington Stewart. So like, I'm assuming, as Richard Kelly seems to be implying in the interview that I read, that it is something to do with aliens.
Right.
But then you're also adding in the concept of like the afterlife, forgiveness, mm-hmm, heaven and hell. And it's like, are aliens involved in these things?
I guess one of these things probably where it's like, you know, our primitive human brains.
Right, sure.
Right.
Can't, like, understand this concept.
So we called it heaven and hell,
right,
but there's just, like, there is something.
There is, like, an afterlife of some kind.
Indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah. Exactly. There's that shit, too.
A similarly kind of suddenly biblical vibe with Southland Tales.
I don't think it was a suddenly biblical vibe.
Yeah,
biblical
that movie, yeah,
throughout.
That movie's pretty biblical throughout.
But I guess, you know, maybe that's just in general a theme that Richard Kelly is very interested in.
I mean, it comes into Donnie Darko too, because Donnie Darko is talking about like...
So I'm thinking about Mother with...
Oh yeah. You guys ever read the Bible?
You ever read the Bible? It's got all these stories in it.
Anyway, go ahead, please.
Even in like Donnie Darko, Richard Kelly is talking to Noah Wiley at one point, mm-hmm, about predetermination and like, are events predetermined? Do you have the concept of free will? So like, again, he seems like he's kind of interested in talking about religion in some respects, even if it never really comes down to a full out religious discussion.
Right.
Seems like that's one of the many topics he likes to talk about.
Aesthetics and music? Did we want to just note on that real quick and then we'll get to
I think
characters?
It's well done. Like, it's a good looking movie.
Yeah,
I think a lot of, like, we had kind of, I don't know if you would even bake this into aesthetics, but a lot of like the director choices, like, I think are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think like we had said, it effectively mimics a paranoia thriller.
Mm-hmm.
The scene,
the
right, yeah, the scenes of like the library where everyone starts just like following them or
that
turning their heads en masse.
Yeah.
Like, that's very effective and creepy. And even, you know, simpler things, like I think the scene where Cameron Diaz actually pushes the button is very well done, because
mm-hmm,
she almost just sort of like does it you would think that there's sort of people are of like a buildup, and all of a sudden she's just kind of like boop, and then it's like she did it.
We're
she fucking
there,
pushed
yeah.
it. Right. She fucking pushed
like
the button.
I like the way it sort of like a second later.
Yeah, it goes like boop and like pulls back up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I do too.
Sort of slowly raises back up.
Yes. Aesthetically speaking, this was shot digitally, and you can tell it was very early on in digital. It almost reminds me of the aesthetics of Scream 4. I don't know if you remember how Scream 4 has like a really sort of weird light bloomy thing going on to
it. Yes, yeah, right. Yeah.
Video games went through a phase.
Yeah, right, sure. And I don't know why that was a thing at the time, but I guess it just was a thing at the time. So this movie does have a lot of that. I don't think it's bad. I'm just saying it's like a choice that
it
was
fits
made.
It's for what it's doing, I think.
Yeah.
Star phase, we had boom phase.
Yes, our bloom phase.
The music is...
Oh, yeah, I think the score by three of the guys from Arcade Fire.
Which you never would have known.
No, I think it's really an interesting score.
I do, too.
And it's at times very sort of heavy-handed and, like, pompous almost, but like
funny.
Yeah, but like I think that's kind of the tone that the movie is going. I think this is something we talked about briefly with Bram Stoker's Dracula, where it's I don't think this is campy. I think this is just sitting in front of a speaker and having it like blast you in the head, you know? Like it's not that it's being silly, it's that it's being like so self-serious and grandiose that it comes off as a little bit comical at times.
I think that the comedy just comes in when the grandiosity is for an establishing shot of an exterior and you're just like, okay.
Yeah.
The music sting of the murder that happens early in the movie, where the cops just find the young daughter in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And we understand the importance of that later.
Right.
But the music is so over the top just for these guys to open the door and it's like, oh, a little girl.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would also say something about, like, the dialogue as written in this movie. So it is also what I would call heavily stylized dialogue, which is to say that most of the time, no character sounds like they're saying things that a person would ever say in real life.
No.
Yeah.
Which is not something I inherently hate. And I think sometimes it works well in this
movie.
Created
a vibe.
Right. And sometimes I think it's ridiculous. Like, the box monologue is one of the times where I'm like, oh boy. Like,
this monologue is just bad.
It is, and it's also prompted by the weird NSA lackey being like, excuse me, sir, why a box? It's
ask
like
a dumb question, get a dumb
right.
Answer.
No, and it's just such a stupid, like, I don't know, like, why not a box?
Hit a button,
what do you got? You wanted me to do a cylinder? You got some cylinders lying around?
It truly felt like it was a test of what can we give to Frank Langella. And he's still going to make
it still
sound
make it
really
sound
good.
Important, yes. Right, yeah. Exactly. There are definitely times where the dialogue in here does not at all sound natural, but it doesn't always bug me, I would say.
I thought it, for the most part, especially the box monologue is one of maybe a very, very silly example, but I thought for the most part it actually effectively created this I'm trapped in a dream or trapped in a nightmare feeling, which I liked.
Yeah,
I liked.
That was something I really enjoyed about
the movie.
Yeah, it's aggressively creepy at various points.
So yeah, we can get into characters and actors.
Well, we'll go real quick. I mean, I think we should start... Let's start with Cameron Diaz, who's ostensibly lead. I think is miscast in this movie.
She's doing that classic Virginian accent.
Well, I don't know why everyone has such a strong accent.
Right, that's the weird thing, too. Right?
Like, I don't think it needs to be this bad. It's just Virginia.
Right.
And I mean, that's like, you could assume that maybe her family relocated or some shit, but like...
Like, everyone around has that accent.
Yeah, no, that's true. There's
Honey,
a lot of...
This isn't like, you know,
it's not
Alabama.
It's not that deep south.
We're on Georgia.
Yeah.
And I didn't grow up in Virginia, but I kind of grew up next to Virginia. People especially in Arlington, in the DC area, would be very rare to have an accent that thick, that southern.
Yeah, like James Marsden is there with her on that level. It's like, tone it down.
I think he fares a little
I think he
better.
Does too. I think
I'm
he's
not
playing...
saying it's bad. I'm saying they're both going for that strength.
Yeah, right. I think Marsden's playing his a little more subtle. Like, Cameron Diaz is sort of playing like high school doing Tennessee Williams play. And it's like, if she had toned that down like 25%, I would probably be a little bit more on board with her portrayal, which I think still has problems to begin with.
Yeah.
I don't know if she was misdirected or if she's just not, you know, suited for this sort of genre
Could
picture.
Be a little bit of both. I also just felt like there were so many times where her character should have had more of a reaction to something. And again, I don't know if that's her, the direction. The scene at the very end where Arlington is like, yeah, your kid is now blind and deaf. Marsden actually has what I would identify as, like, an effective, like, character reaction to that. But hers just feels so, I don't know, delayed, shallow. It was weird.
I don't remember what it was. I'd have to see that
She's
part again.
She's just like,
but...
really? Anyway. James Marsden?
Fine work.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing yeoman's work here, basically. He's trying to play a character who doesn't have a whole lot to do or whose actions I can't quite understand at certain points.
Looks good at those 70s sideburns.
Yeah, good looking guy. I got no beef with Marsden in this movie.
I guess Langella next.
I think Langella's great fantastic. In this, actually. Yeah. Like, whatever.
Yeah, just a really quiet, sort of vaguely ominous.
Yeah. He knows, like, I think he knows, like, the right amount of, like, portentous gravitas to put on every line to make it feel effectively weird and creepy, but not go, like, over the moon with it.
The only time where he loses his handle on it is that your car is a box monologue. Yeah, that is the only time.
I think
that's the only time where the writing overpowers
him. I think
him.
He's still delivering it as best as one could deliver some of that stuff. Like, he's trying in that scene.
All I'm saying is, like, he's amazing, but as an actor, but every other point in the movie, he manages to distract me from how silly his dialogue is.
Yeah.
That was the point where the silliness completely breaks through what he's doing. And it's not that he's doing a bad job. I don't think he could have done anything differently, but that was the one moment where the writing was, like, just, like, sticking out.
Yeah. I don't like the CGI on the face.
Right, so
I think it's an interesting choice.
It's very, I mean, it's like proto Two-Face.
Right, it really is. It really does feel like proto Two-Face. And it feels like one of those things where also they probably didn't have the budget to, like, do it really well. So at various points, his cheek just looks kind of fuzzy when it's interacting with backgrounds.
From some angles, it looked pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I did think it was the one time, the times I liked it was when you could see his teeth.
Yeah.
Kind of like through the side of his cheek, and it would move while he was talking, which I thought was kind of cool. But yeah, in general, especially when they're shooting it from the other side, and you can really see the, like, green tape that was probably just put over here.
Yeah.
If you had to, like, kill someone with something and take over their sort of body, you'd probably... Why are you striking them with lightning and making them lose half their
I wondered, considering how he was like, what did you think about me? Pity? I think it's maybe a part of the test.
I don't know. It seems like you get a lot of tooth infections.
Oh,
once
sure.
No, certainly. They do say something when they talk about how, like,
cellular
they heard him laughing, right? That his, like, healing is advanced and his cellular degeneration stops. So I assume it's just like, yeah, in real life, yeah, you'd be infected as fuck.
Yeah.
But, like, for his magic alien body, it's just sort of in stasis.
Yeah.
I don't know who else we talk about.
Gilly?
I guess. She plays the babysitter. It would have made a lot more sense if she was 13.
Right.
She just looks deer in headlights most of the
time. No, yeah, she does. She kind of wanders through the movie looking slightly terrified the entire time.
Yeah.
Which, again, kind of, I mean, it works to a certain degree because you're like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
What does this person know? Yeah, fun early Gilly role. Yeah, John Magaro as a demon child.
As the little weird kid.
Nothing comes of him.
Yeah. No, it's
he goes,
like,
nowhere.
That's what I'm just saying. Like, because you don't see him, like, going into the portals at the end or something, do you?
No, you don't. It was cracking, not to say that he didn't, but we didn't see a shot of it, but what was cracking me up was every time they would return to him at the rehearsal dinner, and Lee just goes, why? Because it would return to him, and he would just be, like, smirking, kind of, like, evilly. What are we doing?
Yeah.
Sort of my default reaction with, like, anything unsettling or inexplicable. I'm like, why?
Right. That's also one of the moments that I feel is closer to, like, we're getting a little too bizarre here.
Yes.
Where, like, the first scene, especially, where the kid's like, what's wrong with your foot? Show us your foot. And Cameron Diaz is like, fine, I guess I'll show you my foot.
Yeah.
Like, we were saying when watching this, like, there's a way you could do this scene where the teacher is just like, look, you fuckers aren't going to shut up about this. I'm going to show you my damn foot, and we're going to fucking move on, and I never want to hear about this
again.
It
wouldn't have to be so eerie.
Right, because the way it's done in the movie, it almost feels like he has, like, control over her, and he's like, show us your feet, and she's like, okay, and just, like, slips off her shoe.
He does this, like, unblinking, like, Kubrick stare, which is effective, but definitely implies something, like, really wrong is
right
going on.
And I mean, again, like, is he being controlled maybe at this point? Who's to say? And I do love, though, that there's the one girl student who looks at a period and is like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Why are you doing this?
She had no lines, but her face was just yelling at him. Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of it for actors.
I mean, yeah, everyone else is like, James Redporn, fine. Holmes Osborne, fine. Like, I've got no complaints about any of these people. Deborah Rush, again.
Oh,
like,
God.
Love seeing her as Climbing.
And just got to play just a super weirdo with very little explanation.
Yep, absolutely.
I just love that, oh, you're his wife. Yes, I am Climbing.
It really sounded like, again, like she was about to follow that up with some sort of crazy title.
The Warden of the Seventh Moon.
Yes.
Well,
Assistant Youth Director at the BPL.
And now, full-time alien high priestess. Would anyone like to start on fixes?
I've kind of talked about the fact that I don't think that the conspiracy theory layer of this makes any sense. I think if you want to do this as a full movie and we want to focus on it being some sort of greater scale humanity morality test, then I liked the idea of it, the sort of thing Chris kept alluding to, of feeling trapped in a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I would do is sort of extend this idea that, like, aliens or some higher power with, like, in technology indistinguishable from magic are running this test, and that it starts very much in the same way where it's, like, this normal family, normal life in Richmond, or Virginia, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it starts to get more, the box thing happens, and then it's reality starts to, like, break down in weird ways and get more surreal. I think that they're allowed to sort of, you know, wonder about what are the real repercussions of pressing this button, and they can still maybe do some of that weird follow-up stuff,
mm-hmm.
where they hit the button and then realize, like, oh shit, did we fuck up? Was this real? Mm-hmm. We didn't think it was going to be real. And trying to chase down some of that thing, but it being, like, kind of hard and imperceptible, because every time they sort of get somewhere, reality is sort of, like, gets weird, right?
Yeah.
Weird shit happens. People start, you know, become drone-like people and turn around and, you know, all that weird dream stuff that we like is happening. And there's none of this, like, cutaway plot B where the NSA guy is talking to the NASA guy and split, like, yeah, well, it turns out there's these aliens are trying to run the planet. None of that's happening. It's just the two of them ignorant and clueless what the fuck is happening, and people around them being weirder. And, like, the circle tightens, and, like, the dad starts to weird out, and it's clear that, like, he's fucked or corrupted or something not quite real or something. It ends up being, this is all some sort of elaborate, like, they're not in Richmond. When did they stop being in Richmond? We don't know. But they're definitely not in Richmond now. They're in some, there's a simulation or something where these are not, like, this is not a real situation anymore, but they're being experimented on, and they kind of get to this point where they realize that, or they're on the cusp of realizing that something is not right, and they still have to make that sort of final moral choice. But we don't learn. We get no... I want it to be one of those things where, like, we don't learn anything. We don't learn that there's... Like, I'm telling you right now, but, like, we don't know that there's some part of greater morality test. Mm-hmm. For all we know, that there's maybe, like, 100 of these rooms on some alien fucking mothership somewhere where there's, like, a mother couples.
Right.
I was thinking about this other horror movie that I don't think was very good, and I haven't seen it. But it was about this couple that go to a house to either try it out or like, move in. And it's this suburban neighborhood. Where, and then they're told to raise this kid there. And they have to raise it until the kid's 21.
Oh.
And the kid is clearly some alien or some monster or something.
Yeah, this description
Village
is
Village of the Damned?
No, it's not Village of the Damned.
But it's kind of that vibe. And then they try to escape. They can't escape the neighborhood. Uh-huh.
I feel like I remember reading about this.
Yeah,
one,
like I kind of want to have it have that kind of a vibe where it's like sort of illusion that it is real, or kind of like that one episode, that one season of the Creepypasta TV show we watched.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
No End House.
Yeah,
No End House.
Which
that was good.
Yeah, where it's like a planned community and like just vacant.
And they keep thinking they get out, but it's not. They're not
actually
out. It's just another layer of this neighborhood.
Right.
So yeah, that kind of vibe I would have, and just keep it vague. Like just make it be more mysterious and have them less satisfied and. Less did we make the right choice in the end.
Mm-hmm. I can go next. So I think the biggest takeaway, I think the biggest thing about this movie that potentially interests me is just the concept of, and maybe this just feels more relevant today than it might have in 2009, the concept of like, would you be willing to not do something selfish if it meant a net positive for humanity or the world at large? That is a very relevant concept right now. Like, you can continue to do shitty things to enrich yourself, but you could also not do shitty things and you would be financially punished in some way in that respect. You won't be as wealthy as you are now, but it would be better for humanity. And just seeing how people are by and large sort of like, but what about me in all of this? And so that's kind of the test that I like to deal with more. I think I would have Arthur and Norma not necessarily be a couple who is in as severe financial straits as they seem to be. I think one of the biggest takeaways I had while watching this, Lee, is something you bring up before, is them with their backs against the wall is orchestrated by some sort of government organization or something. Then you're not really doing a fair test. You're just sort of like already changing the variables at that point.
Yeah.
So I want it to just sort of be something based on that. I think you still have the same concept of the box where it's just if you push the button, you will get $1 million. And someone will die. If you don't, nothing will happen and you pass the test. Good job. You didn't get that money, but you did good. Like, you get a gold star for being such a good kid. And so it's just one of those things where it's like you have nothing to gain ostensibly by not pushing this button as you see it. If you think it's all a hoax, then it doesn't really matter if you push it anyways. Why would you not possibly push this button? I do sort of like the concept of it being something to do with aliens in some respect. Like, I do kind of like that. There's a deleted segment from the screenplay that I read, which kind of alludes to the idea that the government is involved in this because the government has some sort of contingency plan where if they were ever to encounter extraterrestrial intelligence that seemed more advanced than we were, we would cooperate with them up until a time that we're able to use whatever technology they will share with us to better ourselves and, like, act against them, which again feels like something you can tie into, like, the premise of this. Like, if someone else shows up and is like, hey, we're calling the shots now, like, would you sort of go along with it? Would you? I don't know. Those are sort of, like, the two vague concepts that I wish were sort of built up more. This whole thing is so difficult for me to do. I feel like we talked about this when we did Paul Hartley movies, where it's just like, it's so hard for me to go into a movie that's clearly personal and represents the vision that the person had and be like, I think you need to do this instead, because right. like you're clearly doing what you wanted to do here, even if you ran out of time or money or what have you. So this is a difficult fix for me, but I think it's just sort of, I would kind of wanted to go with that. I like the idea of it being some sort of shadowy government alien conspiracy, and I like the idea of just sort of being, let's find out if humans will actually do anything that could potentially better other people versus them making a selfish decision for themselves.
I really like that.
Thank you.
Mine was actually somewhat similar to what Lee described.
Oh, ho, ho.
Been reading Lee's diary again, have you?
Yeah, I just can't stay away. gotta find out what she's up to. I thought for a while about how, like, just what you were discussing, mm-hmm. that the test being offered here is not a clean one. Mm-hmm. And I would even say it sort of puts whoever it's in an impossible position, because you are meant to make a quote-unquote moral choice
right.
that's asking you to basically take on the responsibility that should be the system's. Similar to how, like, Dark City is, like, an alien construct right. where they just are rearranging us into different things.
Right.
I want this to be, the government is working with a small group of aliens in a space that people think is, or the people within it think is, you know, Arlington or Richmond, Virginia. Yeah. But it's really just this constantly, like, turning simulation in which different morality choice games are being played with the people that live within. And the aliens are attempting to figure out, like, how quote-unquote moral we are. But I would love for the main character to essentially kind of wake up from this reality, be able to crack through that conspiracy, and essentially try to... The point of that story would just be that our idea, or like that test idea of what is moral, has way more to do with punishing people who are already victims of a terrible system mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. than they are of actually identifying or proving morality.
Yeah.
That just this idea of trying to test people into being moral is just sort of ridiculous and dumb to begin with. As confusing as this movie was, I really did genuinely enjoy parts of it. And I think that its tone is, like, genuinely unsettling and creepy and cool.
I think there's an interesting thing to be said, the idea that, like, the government cooperating with the aliens on this morality test, and the government having a different idea about morality, and the aliens having a different mm-hmm. than the aliens.
Yeah.
And the aliens are actually testing not just humanity, but the government's idea of what they're
right.
Yeah, I mean, that's potentially an interesting story to yeah, yeah. to tell too.
You're okay with me doing this to your own people,
or just yeah. even just in general, like things,
or like
that, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. That's how you see. Like we're the aliens are letting the government come up with the parameters of the test, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
So then the aliens are like, well, that's interesting.
Right, it's interesting that you view this as a moral thing to yes. do when we would never. View this as a moral
yes,
thing to
like
do.
I like that angle. Yeah. I mean, we come to the big question. Would you recommend this film?
It's a weird one. How long was it? It felt kind of
2 hours.
It's a little over
two. It's a bit long, but, you know, if you like this kind of weird shit, and if you, you know, just...
I would say if you enjoyed a Richard Kelly movie, I would definitely say check this out.
I would absolutely recommend this. Yeah. I enjoyed this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those things, yeah. again, like, I can't say it all makes sense. I can't say it's even necessarily good,
right.
but it's effective, and it's interesting, and it's confusing in a way that I respond to, sort of, you know. I know
yeah.
it's not something that everyone will respond to, and if you don't enjoy this, I get it. I get why you
yeah,
wouldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
But this works for me. It's probably my least favorite of his three movies.
Oh, easily.
But I still think it's kind of interesting.
Oh, I think it's very interesting. I think the ways that it fails are still quite interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard Kelly's an interesting... I love that the thing with Richard Kelly is... He's always going to have tons of ideas. They're always going to be way too big,
mm-hmm.
and there's going to be way too many of them, but I don't know. There's just something really cool and ambitious about the stories he tries to tell.
Yeah,
film.
My biggest takeaway is it's not boring. This movie
no.
is not boring. It's
no.
perplexing and frustrating and bizarre, but it's never boring. So
and
it's got that going for
I
it.
Defy you to find another movie like it. Like,
yeah,
I mean.
No, again. Again, yeah. I'm pretty sure I said this at Southland Tales. I wish he would make another movie.
Me
so
too.
Here's hoping that someday it'll happen.
He's going to crowdfund.
Do you hear that?
Seriously, I would.
Do you hear that, Richard Kelly?
That's how Hal Hartley's made the first two movies.
Yeah.
I'd fund them.
It could work.
All right. And that's the signal for an episode wrap up.
Yeah.
You know, facebook.com/whywatchpod.
Yeah, cast. I don't think you need to worry about Facebook so much anymore. There's just a website. The website is draftpack.com. Oh, I feel like that's what I would be more focused on at this point. It's got episodes and stuff there. So I would just go there and, you know, various podcast apps to subscribe, rate, whatever.
5 stars, please.
Yeah. Yep.
I couldn't think of a watery alien way.
You could just bite out with your best southern accent.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.